It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, five Memphis police officers are charged with second-degree murder after the beating death of Tyre Nichols. We'll talk with an expert on race about policing and about what needs to change and how to best go about it. First, new guidelines on childhood obesity say there's no reason to delay treatment for the complex disease and suggests it should be destigmatized. The guidelines released earlier this month by the American Academy of Pediatrics detail the long and short-term health effects of childhood obesity. Now, obesity rates around the country are increasing, and in Wisconsin, a 2020 study by the National Survey of Children's Health shows that almost 15% of 10 to 17-year-olds are considered obese. So join this conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about destigmatizing childhood obesity? Did you deal with childhood obesity as a kid? What treatments did you try? What worked or didn't work for you? And what do you wish you knew back then that you know today? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Brian Lynch is a pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center. He works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Lynch, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Yes, I'm so happy to be here and a part of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics' new recommendation stressed that obesity is not just a consequence of poor eating habits or a lack of exercise, but obesity is a chronic disease with many intertwined causes, including genetics. And how does this inform the Academy when it came to the new guidelines for dealing with childhood obesity?
Yeah, first off, childhood obesity is a very significant public health problem. There's 14.4 million children and adolescents in the U.S. that have obesity. It makes it one of the most common pediatric chronic diseases. The percentage of U.S. children and adolescents with obesity has almost quadrupled from 5% in the mid-60s to 19% here in 2018. And the COVID pandemic is associated with even an increase in concerns with the obesity epidemic. So there's lots of things fueling this. And one of the things that we've learned, and it's not just diet and physical activity, but many social determinants of health, including family stress, can really be fueling this pandemic.
What about socioeconomic status?
Yeah, that's definitely a factor that's now much better understood to be a risk factor for obesity, and certainly poverty, race, the community, underserved communities. These are all risk factors for being obese outside of your dietary habits and your genetics.
So how has treating childhood obesity evolved as you see it, Dr. Lynch?
Well, with this statement, it's evolving a lot. The mainstay of treatment has been health behavior and lifestyle treatment. And this has been going on the last few decades, and it's most effective when it's face-to-face, when it involves the whole family, and when it delivers at least 26 hours of nutrition, physical activity, and behavior change over 3 to 12 months. And this can be done, you know, at different places in the community, at weight management clinics or at academic centers. But certainly the new statement discusses the use of especially earlier intensive therapy and the use of medications and bariatric surgery earlier than we've traditionally done.
And why the intensive early interventions with medications and potential for surgeries? Why is the American Academy of Pediatrics now looking at this for earlier and earlier in a child's development?
Well, for a few reasons, and most of the evidence shows that we really need to rethink our approach to childhood obesity treatment. Now, as I mentioned before, the epidemic grows, yet, you know, and our current interventions just haven't been effective. You know, with intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatment, we can get modest improvement, maybe 1 to 3% improvement in weight. If you add medications to that, at least some of the current ones that are new over the last 5 to 10 years, that can increase that up to 5%. And the numbers are staggering with bariatric surgery, where improvements can be sustained up to 20% of weight loss. So taking this data, we probably need to be utilizing these more aggressive interventions earlier than we have in the past.
Dr.
And one thing we know about obesity, if we can prevent it or we can mitigate the concerns with it early in childhood, we get a lot better outcomes.
Dr. Brian Lynch, our guest, pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center, who works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at the Mayo Clinic. And you're welcome to join our conversation with the new guidelines out now from the American Academy of Pediatrics at 1-800-642-1234. Are you dealing with this in your own family today? And how are you dealing with it? And what questions would you have about dealing with it better? One of the factors that is included in this is genetics. Dr. Lynch, what can be done about our genetics?
Well, there are some things that can affect genetics. A lot we can't change, but certainly we're learning about epigenetics, the idea that your environmental and life experiences can really change, your genes in your body and what's then passed on to your offspring. So we've learned that through stress in society, through difficult times like wartime periods or plagues, that there can be multiple generational effects on health. So certainly we know that positive experiences in life, getting support from family, friends, and neighbors, having safe neighborhoods, these things can have positive effects on epigenetics. Of course, we're learning about negative effects too, like adverse childhood experiences, like experiencing abuse and neglect, or living in an environment that's not supportive, or experiencing racism or discrimination. So there are things that can affect genetics that we're really learning after the last decade, and that can really potentially be areas that we can address with the obesity epidemic.
And Dr. Lynch, is this one of the reasons that the Academy of Pediatrics new guidelines call for when it comes for treatment of childhood obesity, not just intensive treatment with the child, but also the entire family?
Yeah, there's lots of evidence that family-focused treatment plans are much more effective, and for many reasons. But, certainly the mainstay of treatment is changing health habits. And if the whole family's doing that, it's a lot more effective and easier to implement than if it's just for one child within the family.
And what about socioeconomic status? How do you go about dealing with that?
Well, that's a much broader issue that, difficult to solve in the clinic office. But I think it's important to understand and recognize that socioeconomic status and other social determinants of health do impact health status. And sometimes just explaining that to families can help them understand maybe why there's so many significant health problems they're experiencing, including obesity. At a societal level, though, it just shows how important it is to try to impact these social determinants of health and how it affects not only the obesity epidemic, but other chronic health diseases also.
Let us go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Dr. Brian Lynch, pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center. Sue in Eau Claire, good afternoon.
Hi, I'm just wondering what work, if any, has been done in relation to looking at the levels of organophosphates and other herbicides, pesticides that are applied to food, and how that might contribute to obesity. I've worked with adults with obesity, and from a functional medicine perspective, which is approved by the AMA, there is testing that can be done, and some of those levels in us, in the adults, are extremely high, and lowering those can help with digestion and absorption, which contributes to helping with the obesity. And I'll take my answer off air unless there's further questions.
Sue, I appreciate your questions. And Dr. Lynch, what do we know about the connections between obesity and organophosphates or other pesticides?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any studies with organophosphates or other pesticides, but there is lots of data that processed food intake and sugar-containing food intake are definitely fueling factors for this obesity epidemic. And these are things we need to address both at an individual level and societal level to try to make these less healthy and unhealthy foods less available for the general public.
Well, and what role, what place do sugary drinks have in that equation?
Oh, they certainly have a large piece. Certainly, that's one of the things I emphasize when I'm in my pediatric practice and talking to families. And that's really all families, not just with families with children with obesity. But to focus on trying to cutting down on sugar-containing beverages and try to drink more water and low-fat milk, is the primary beverage intake. Because when you drink a sugary beverage, you're generally not very full. You still might be getting a lot of calories, and then you tend to eat even on top of that. So, and because these are so readily available and cheap, certainly it's been something that's fueled this epidemic over the last three decades.
We're talking with Dr. Brian Lynch, a pediatrician at Mayo Clinic's Children's Center. He works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at Mayo Clinic. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about how we treat childhood obesity? What would you like to see change when it comes to how we approach childhood obesity as a nation, in our society, in our households? And what questions do you have about how we can do better for our kids? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Dr. Brian Lynch, a pediatrician at Mayo Clinic's Children's Center, taking a look at new guidelines for childhood obesity and how to treat this complex disease. What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234. What stories do you have to share about childhood obesity in the U.S., in your household? What do you think about its treatments? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas@WPR.org. And Dr. Lynch, if you would, just briefly go through some of these treatments the guidelines talk about. What do these treatments look like?
Yeah, so the first-line treatment is still the same as it's been the last, three decades, and that's intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatment. Now, that's ideally done at a comprehensive clinic that are usually, at an academic medical center or in the community. Unfortunately, these treatment facilities aren't available in many communities in the United States, and families should then work with their pediatric health care providers, local dietitians, psychologists, exercise specialists, and other community resources to address behavioral health change. Every community has different resources that can be helpful. Here, where I work in Rochester, Minnesota, there's been lots of great programming with the schools, the YMCA, and the Boys and Girls Club, among many other organizations.
And Dr. Lynch, when we are figuring out if a child is obese or not, what are our measurements like, and are we accurate in using them? Are we missing obesity to some degree with the way we measure it? Or what do you think about the BMI and how we count somebody as obese?
Yeah, that's a great question. So weight status in our pediatric clinics is defined using the body mass index percentile, which is the weight in kilograms divided by the height in meters squared, and then plot it out in a percentile line based upon age and sex. So it's essentially a body thickness level. And for most individuals, the body mass index is well correlated with direct measures of body fat. So in generally, it does a good job. Certainly, we run into times it's not as effective, especially with children, adolescents with a lot of muscle mass. But, in terms of defining obesity, typically it's defined as overweight if you're at the 85th percentile up to the 95th. If you're above the 95th, you're considered obese. If you're above the 99th percentile, it's severe obesity.
Dr. Brian Lynch, our guest, pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic Children's Center, works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at Mayo Clinic. And we return to your calls, questions, and stories this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. We're Dave and Verona standing by. Dave, good afternoon.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've got a question for the doctor. I know there's a tremendous focus on childhood obesity, but I wonder if there's a disconnect in that when parents bring their children into doctor's offices, Is it your opinion that doctors are pretty aggressive at pointing out obesity issues, or is there a big concern about body shaming such that they really don't address those issues when parents bring their children in for physicals, for example? I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Dave, thank you. Dr. Lynch?
Yeah, Dave, that's a great question. So it's very important to acknowledge that individuals with obesity experience weight stigma, victimization, teasing, and bullying, all which contribute to that child or adolescent having social isolation, avoidance of healthcare services, maybe decreased physical activity, and even potentially disordered eating behavior. And so I do think it makes many practitioners hesitant sometimes to address this as aggressively as currently recommended in this new policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics. I think that we can work with families to accept body shape and address weight status at the same time. And I think a lot of it has to do with how we discuss and talk about the problem. And I think this relates to practitioners, but it also just relates to all of us. For one, I think it's important to acknowledge that obesity is primarily a societal problem. It's not a personal choice issue. And we really need to work on providing empathy to individuals who have obesity. Secondly, I think we need to avoid stigmatizing language. Like in the clinic, I try to use terms like unhealthy weight, or I use that body mass index percentile when discussing weight status, and stay away from words like obese or chubby. It's also important to use first-person language. So an example of that would say a child with obesity rather than calling a child an obese child. And lastly, as a practitioner, it's very important that I try to be sensitive and compassionate in communicating with families and really focus my efforts on the habits more than the weight goal. So we've really shifted that in the last 5 to 10 years because that helps prevent eating disorders, plus it helps really focus on things that are doable and feasible for families to address.
So when you talk about obesity as a societal problem, you would also talk about obesity in terms of a family solution, correct?
Yes. I mean, there's both factors. But yeah. The primary driver, in my opinion, of this epidemic over the last three decades is issues with society. You know, the socio-ecological environment, the overall environment, versus the personal choice issues, which are still important and can still impact outcomes, but I think they're not the primary drivers. It's just very difficult to sustain healthy behavior changes in an environment that promotes high energy intake foods, unhealthy dietary choices, and sedentary behavior, including lots of recreational screen time.
Let's continue with your calls now for Dr. Brian Lynch. Charlene in Eau Claire, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just a little frustrated at your guest's continual contention that kids are getting fat because of lifestyle choices. And he was also saying it's because of socioeconomic factors. They're poor or because of stress in the home. Well, I was a kid in the 70s from an alcoholic family, plenty of stress. And then after my parents got divorced, we were poor. After my parents got divorced, my single mom was too tired to cook, so she fed my brother and I on a steady diet of Burger King and McDonald's. We drank tons of sugary pops. I had, you know, those are all, and we sat around playing video games all day. Those are all the factors he listed, and yet my brother and I and all our friends going through the same thing, we're not fat. What's the difference? It's because of all the chemicals in the food and endocrine disruptors that are in all the chemicals that are everywhere now. And I'm just frustrated that they keep saying it's, you know, lifestyle changes. It's not. And there are a lot of these things, well, some of it might be, but a lot of these are things we can't do anything about. And it's super frustrating. And it's, you know, not just childhood obesity, it's adult obesity too. We're all affected by these things.
Charlene, thank you. I believe we did mention genetics as one of the other things that would not be necessarily a controlling factor in this, but one of the factors in it. But what about the stigma, Dr. Lynch? And can that stigma of obesity actually compound the problem?
Certainly, the stigma is a huge issue, and that's one thing that I'm glad that this policy statement addressed. And as I mentioned before, it's very important that we all recognize that there is a stigma with obesity and work to mitigate that. We have a long way to go as a society to do that. And Charlene, thanks for sharing your story. And certainly you've been through a lot in your life, and you've had, good outcomes with your weight status. And I've discussed things that have evidence that are generally things that we can do and impact. There's lots of things impacting this epidemic that a lot of us don't have any impact on. And that's a major problem. And I guess one of the points I want to make sure our audience understands is that a lot of this is societal level problems. They're going to take public policy, higher level changes to really impact health in making our food healthier and making healthy food more affordable and cutting out things in foods that are unhealthy. And like I said before, the most evidence of concern currently is with the processed foods and sugar-containing foods. So these are big things, but every individual is different. And we focus on concerning individual factors. There's also many protective individual factors that can help promote healthy outcomes, not just with weight, but with other chronic diseases also. And it's important, anytime we look at someone's health, we look at what the challenging factors in their lives, but also the positive factors that can build it up. And I think we need to focus more on those positive factors, both in the medical office and in our society.
Dr. Lynch, we are out of time, but I thank you so much for yours this afternoon.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it a lot.
Dr. Brian Lynch, a pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic's Children's Center. He works with the American Academy of Pediatrics and co-leads a primary care obesity task force at the Mayo Clinic. He talked with us about the American Academy of Pediatrics' new guidelines regarding childhood obesity, including the long and short-term effects of the disease and childhood obesity treatment. And there's still time for you to join this conversation. Sorry we didn't get to all of your calls, but you can always email us and we'll continue it at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Now, coming up after the news, we'll talk about the death of Tyre Nichols at the hands of the police in Memphis and what it tells us about policing in America, how far we've come and how far we have to go, and what it would take to make it safer. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, a tribal historic preservation officer for the St. Croix Chippewa of Wisconsin joins us with an invitation to hear the stories of our land and its First Nations. Now, five police officers in Memphis were charged with second-degree murder last week after they were captured on video beating 29-year-old Tyre Nichols, who died 3 days later. Today, another officer was suspended from duty. The beating occurred after a traffic stop for erratic driving, something the Memphis Police Department says it has yet to confirm. Nichols, a photographer and father, fled officers but was unarmed and did not show signs of fighting back. The incident led to peaceful protests in Memphis as well as other cities over the weekend. Lawmakers in Tennessee and at the federal level have already called for more reforms in police training and use of force policies. And we're talking now about what all this can tell us about policing in America today. And we invite you to join us. What was your reaction to the death of Tyre Nichols? Did you see the video? What do you think can be done to make policing better and incidents like this less common? 1-800-642-1234. Do you hope to see officers be held accountable more often? And if you work in law enforcement, show us what you see through your eyes. 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He directs the Institutional Anti-Racism and Accountability Project. He's co-host of the podcast Some of My Best Friends Are and is author of the book The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Khalil, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Would like to get your reaction of what you saw on Friday and what you're left feeling with today.
Well, I saw the disturbing execution of a man who, by any reasonable determination, did nothing, absolutely nothing, to deserve to die. And while this one incident has yet again forced a national conversation about state violence or police brutality and police murder in particular, we simply don't know how many other Tyre Nichols go unscathed in the most lethal sense of the term after having endured some form of brutalization, because we don't keep track of such things, which is a big problem. But we do know that more people have died this year, according to informal tracking methods, than have died over the last several years by the hands of police. So we're moving in the wrong direction.
After other officer-involved killings in recent years, a good deal of the media attention has been about race, often about a white officer attacking a person of color. In this case, all five officers are Black. Is this a time to start thinking about how the institution of policing is bigger than just the race of the officers, Khalil?
It's always been that case. While most Americans are taught at some point or socialized or hear in a news story to think of these incidents as the consequence of individual officers, of rotten apples, it is the institution itself of policing that for most of history and most especially in the last 100 years has more keenly focused its resources on Black and brown low-income communities than any other. And of course, listeners will say, but that's where the crime is. That is true to a degree. What is not true is just because there is crime there doesn't mean that we get this kind of policing. So the issue here is that institutional racism has given license to the kind of daily brutalities that have been reported on, have been cited in Department of Justice investigations, all the way up to the most lethal incidences of unarmed innocent people. I mean, let's just lean into it. I mean, Tyre Nichols had not been adjudicated in court for having broken a crime, let alone accused of anything more than a potential traffic violation. So this is the issue. Institutional racism is part of a longer history and context in which Black people get a certain kind of policing, no matter who the police officers are, whether they are Black or white. The man, when Derek Chauvin was had his knee on the neck of George Floyd, two other men of color were there by his side. When people were killed on the Danziger Bridge in 2005 in the midst of the Hurricane Katrina disaster, people were shot in the back by police officers. One of them charged with murder in that case was a Black man along with white officers. In the case of the killing of Freddie Gray, six officers were accused of being responsible for his death, which was part of a process of putting him unsecure in the back of a police van. Three of those officers who were ultimately acquitted in that case were Black. So we've been having a conversation that also includes the behavior of Black officers.
Do you take any heart in the rather comparatively quick accountability of seeing criminal charges against these five police officers from Memphis?
Absolutely. I think that had this been the history alongside the one I just told, this might have ended a generation ago. But for the most part, what happened in the case of these five, and to be clear, Black officers, is exceptional.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, our guest, professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, taking your questions as well today at 1-800-642-1234, where Tina in Lake Geneva is standing by. Tina, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I am the mother of a biracial child who's half Black. So watching the video and him crying out 800 yards from his mother's home, crying for his mother, was probably one of the most disturbing things I've seen. It's heartbreaking, and we should all be concerned about this matter. But as a mental health professional, I want to hear more discussions about the emotional dysregulation of every one of those police officers on the video. Even if this young man was driving in an incorrect manner, the way that you respond to him, you're required to have emotional regulation, which means you do not go to the door and say, why the F are you effing this, and I'm going to drag you out of the effing car. It should have been calm. This man never brandished a weapon, and I just want to see more done for mental health concerns for law enforcement beyond racism.
Tina, thank you for your perspective as well as your question when it comes to what can be done. You know, better police training. I mean, a lot of the video that I saw on Friday was the after the beating was police, you know, not attending 7 minutes of emergency personnel not attending to Tyree after the beating. And a certain sense of detachment from the police officers appeared clear, Khalil.
No, I think that's that is telling us that there's more going on in the culture of emergency response in addition to policing. There is a level of deference to the scene of a police stop where everyone essentially immediately falls in line that some horrible person has been captured. Someone akin to a domestic terrorist that we must all stand back and engage in the least productive manner. I want to add something to what Tina said, because there is ongoing research at the Center for Policing Equity, work being done to look particularly at the screening processes of police departments around the country, because we already have good evidence that policing attracts a certain kind of warrior mentality on top of people who are recruited for their military experience. And certain people's personality profiles show up aside from whether they have strong anti-Black bias or anti-Brown bias, are much more likely to engage in violence, are much more likely to be short-tempered. The problem here is probably within that context, yes, but even worse, because this was a street crimes unit that was essentially designed to be people who would be aggressive. Mm-hmm. And the question is, why would a street crimes unit generally deploy to look for guns or drug dealing or to get violent people off the street be so aggressive over a motor violation, other than the fact that it was a pretext stop, which means that if you have a young Black man driving in a car and have a reason to pull that person over, that's good enough. And that's what makes this fundamentally about structural racism.
Back to your calls with our guest, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, now at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Marlon in Madison. Good afternoon, Marlon.
Hello. This is Marlon Banks.
Hi, Marlon.
Hi. I was just leaving a comment saying that I don't really think anything is going to change unless we have some type of national forum. Otherwise, it's just going to continue like some type of mathematical constant in an equation. You have to have a different variable that's going to make a difference. And I don't think, just like in this case where they address the issue of crime or violence in particular neighborhoods by putting more African-Americans on particular scorpion forces like this one, that's not going to do it. And I'm recalling back to, I'm a retired school teacher now. I was a special education teacher for the district here in Madison. And our diversity training days were the quietest day of the school year. I think partly that was because, like in my case, I was the only African-American teacher in the building. And so everyone was afraid of saying something that might sound racist, so they would say nothing. And then they always expected me to speak first. Right. So and then there were people were afraid of offending me by saying something that might be misconstrued as racist. Well, that's what I mean. There has to be a different variable. It can't just be Black people speaking about issues of race.
I thank you, Marlon. And it can't just be Black people speaking about issues of race, Khalil. There has to be a different variable, Marlon says. And what would that variable be?
Well, I think we are probably reaching the limits of so-called training to solve for this problem. The movement to do really fundamental criminal justice reform and policing reform was upended over the past year and a half, even in places like Minneapolis, New York City. A lot of municipalities and cities turned away from some of the boldest suggestions that came forth after the killing of George Floyd. And the truth is that what we've replaced those proposals with is more funding for police officers in the form of more training. So we have to come to terms with the fact that policing, by definition, is a limited tool to address a range of social problems that exist in our society. And until we develop our capacity to find the right tools, not, I shouldn't say that, to deploy the correct tools to solve for the right problems, then we're going to have this problem. We have systems that are not perfect, and they also have anti-Black bias and structural racism baked into them, but they are far less lethal, and they have the capacity to improve dramatically outcomes where people actually can get the help that they deserve. Some examples right now, and I'll stop with this quick example, is some municipalities such as Ithaca, New York, have simply stopped using the police to do low-level traffic enforcement. So, of course, what happened to Tyre Nichols would not have happened in the first place because officers would not have pulled over someone over something that appeared to be minor. What they would have done is taken his license plate and sent him a ticket for a traffic violation.
We're talking with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard University. And we're looking at the death of Tyre Nichols at the hands of Memphis police officers and what it tells us about policing and what can change. And you can join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard. He's also the author of the book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, taking a look at the murder of Tyre Nichols in Memphis, with five city police officers being charged with second-degree homicide last week, and taking your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234, where Martha and Rhinelander are standing by. Martha, good afternoon.
Hi. I just have an observation, I guess. My mother and I both had several uncles and policemen that were several uncles and cousins who were policemen in the city of Chicago. Some were in the seedier parts of Chicago, which is in every city. Some were Michigan Avenue and Lincoln Park, which is very ritzy areas. My uncle spent 30 years in the field, and he was so jaded by the time he retired. It was awful. His son retired after 30 years of having been in a nicer neighborhood. And I know I'm you know, singling out nice neighborhoods and seedy neighborhoods, but is there any thought ever to anyone revamping the police in terms of, you know, 10 years in the field, 10 years on the desk, 10 years training other policemen? I mean, 30 people can't be 30 years in the field. I know these policemen that killed Tyre Nichols were all on the medium to younger side, but you can't be expected to see some of the things policemen see and retain your humanity. I just think 30 years in the field is too much, and you know, I think they have to screen better for people who are, you know, more racist, more narrow-minded, and basically cruel. But the 10-10-10 idea, I think, is a long time coming and should be looked at.
Well, let's ask our guest, Khalil. Where do you think the focus should be for policy changes? Should it sound like something Martha's offering?
Well, I think Martha's spot on, and I appreciate her sharing her family's experience. She's spot on in, again, bringing our attention to better screening of people who are selected for law enforcement in the first place. One of the things that the federal legislation that did not pass in the wake of the George Floyd killing, the George Floyd and Policing Act, called for essentially making the history of officers available to the federal government as a registry so that people wouldn't be shifted and moved around from one police agency to another if they had a history of brutality or of high levels of complaints against them. So Martha's right about we can do far better in terms of screening out and tracking people who have a history of abuse. I have not heard the 10-10-10 plan, but it sounds very compelling. And I think it's worth, you know, throwing all the really possible ideas for change on the board. So I'm just going to affirm for Martha that that she may be onto something.
Martha, thank you for the call. And Khalil, I want to ask you, like, we've seen the numbers, the statistics. Milwaukee's just one of the many major cities that saw a rise in homicides over the last few years. And how do you think those cities can balance public safety with not over-policing or using tactics that feel like they're attacking communities that they're charged to keeping safe?
Well, there's two roads that we should be traveling at this point. First of all, we talk about, and this is context for the answer, we talk about the resurgence of violent crime as if we live in a historical vacuum. We've been down this road before. The difference is that what happened in the mid-1980s and the early 90s had led to both the high rates of violence and massive incarceration of people is that we can't really build a system any bigger or more punitive than we already have. That should tell us that that tool of punitive responses from policing to incarceration is not going to be the best approach going forward. If we were to see the return of levels of violence that we saw 25 years ago, I can't even imagine what kind of police state that most of us would be witness to and live in if we try to outdo what we've already done. What we can do is we can take 20 years of evidence-based and proven approaches of community violence interruption, which comes in many different forms, but one form in particular is to work with people who already are in the community, who are credible messengers, sometimes as formerly incarcerated people, who can work to prevent conflict from escalating. This is called cure violence in some places. It's called ceasefire in other places. And in other places, it goes by a different name. We are underfunding a tool that we already have at our disposal to address community violence. It is less lethal. It is far more effective. And it will free police officers to do things that they do well, which is, in this case, to respond to calls for service. In these cases, they're not even necessarily calls for service because community violence interrupters are already in the community. They know where the retaliation is going to occur. They know who's more likely to engage in carjacking or other forms of violence that are terrorizing to people who live in those communities.
And just to be clear here, you talked earlier, Khalil, about this range of societal problems or social problems that exist in society, and we ask the police to deal with them all. Is it unfair of us to be asking the police to continue to expand the things that they are charged with controlling, keeping, being in charge of it all?
That's absolutely. And police officers will tell you this themselves. I just served on a 2-year consensus study by the National Academies of Sciences. We talked to several police officers before issuing our report, and people are free to download the report at the National Academy of Sciences. The report is free to download. And what we know is that police officers don't want to be called to deal with someone locked out of their home, to deal with the cat in the tree, to deal with the misbehaving child who's not listening to their parents. And yet, in most cases, municipalities expect their officers to at least show some goodwill towards those calls. So we, as citizens of these communities, are contributing to the problem ourselves and certainly not offering the kind of support that leaders and municipal leaders need to redirect or to create new resources that would be more suited for most of the calls for service. Most people don't realize that only about 5% of arrest activity in this country is related to violent offenses. The vast majority of things that police officers are called for have nothing to do with violence.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, if we were to make one change that would make a difference in a way where we would not see stories like these come up again in the way that they've come up in the past, what would it be?
I think because this is a very decentralized problem, we have 18,000 versions of a law enforcement agency. I honestly think that dealing with the collective bargaining agreements that limit what happened in Memphis in too many instances, that is swift termination and the filing of legal charges that stick, which has to do with qualified immunity as well. If we can make the possibility that those collective bargaining agreements would no longer protect officers from their own abusive and criminal behavior. When it rises to that, we can go a long way to changing the incentive structures that allow people to sometimes get away with murder.
Hey, Khalil, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard. Also the author of the book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. He's also the co-host of the podcast, Some of My Best Friends Are, with one of his best friends. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, how Wisconsin fits into Amtrak's broader vision for passenger rail connecting the Midwest to everywhere else. Kate Archer Kent meets with the Amtrak's new director of network development for the Central Region. Perhaps some perspective on the return of our bone-chillingly cold weather. 14-year-old Isaac Ortman from Duluth, Minnesota, has been sleeping outside since the sixth grade. Isaac Ortman has slept outside as the temperature dipped to 38 below. He celebrated his 1,000th night on January 12th, burrowing inside a snow shelter built with the help of his fellow Boy Scouts and his dad, the troop scoutmaster. Isaac Ortman has also slept in tents and hammocks and a fishing boat. He slept outside after breaking his wrist. He slept outside with a 102-degree fever. He even slept outside after a bear walked up to his family's patio door. Isaac told the Washington Post he won't stop and might even sleep outside through college. Wind chills could drop to 26 below in Duluth tonight, and Isaac's expected to be out there safely. So as you curse your biting cold, making your way between heated car and heated home, you can warm yourself tonight with the thoughts of 14-year-old Isaac Ortman. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.